delighted to welcome for this oral argument students from Mid-State Technical School. Would they please stand? Thank you very much for coming. You may be seated. I'm told that you were here after the second oral argument to meet with Justice Robinsack to discuss the procedures of the court. And good. Do you have a summary of the case we're about to hear? Or would you like a summary? You have a summary. Good. Okay. Let me, now that we've met you, let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. He is seated next to Justice Patience Robinsack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. To her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will call our last case today, 07 AP 1198, Kenosha Professional Firefighters versus the City of Kenosha. Arguing on behalf of the Kenosha Professional Firefighters is Jeffrey Sweetland. Mr. Sweetland.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. It's the court. I am Attorney Jeffrey Sweetland. I'm here on behalf of the Kenosha Professional Firefighters and Alan Horgan, who filed a petition for writ of mandamus under the Wisconsin Open Records Law, requesting that the City of Kenosha provide them with certain documents relating to a number of the chiefs in the Kenosha Fire Department. Two of the types of documents that they requested were the chief's job applications and the matrix scores that the chiefs had achieved on some examinations that they had taken in connection with the selection process. These scores were called matrix scores. The city initially resisted production of both types of documents. It acknowledged that it had the applications, but it insisted that there were reasons why those applications did not have to be produced. With respect to the matrix scores, the city said, we don't have those scores. We turned them over to a third-party contractor that assisted us in the selection process. And since they are in the hands of the third-party contractor, we are not obliged to produce them. As the proceeding went along, we had a hearing before the circuit court in Kenosha. The city there agreed that if they had the matrix scores, they would have had to produce them under the open records law. And the city said that they understood that the mere fact that they had turned the scores over to a third-party contractor did not relieve them of that obligation, but they said that they had heard from the third-party contractor that those scores were no longer in existence, that they had been destroyed. And they produced an affidavit from the city's own, people in the city's own human relations department, saying that he had been told by representatives of the contractor that these scores had been destroyed. The petitioners took the position at that hearing that they were not, they should not have to rely on that hearsay declaration from the city's employee to dispose of their demand for the matrix scores, and indicated that they would want to take further discovery on that matter. The circuit court agreed that the applications were subject to the open records law and entered its writ of mandamus, which directed the city to produce the applications, entered the writ on April 27, 2006. With respect to the matrix scores, the court, the writ stated in paragraphs 7 and 8, the city and the custodian having conceded that the matrix scores constituted public records, but having represented that the third-party contractor that had custody of the matrix scores had destroyed them in the ordinary course of business before the requesters requested their disclosure, the court requests that the city and the custodian obtain an affidavit from a representative of the contractor based on personal knowledge that no record of the matrix scores now exists, that all such records were destroyed before the requesters requested them, that there are no residual files in any of the contractor's computers or documents where the information sought would reside, and that the contractor has no information as to how any of that destroyed material could be retrieved. Paragraph 8 of the writ stated, the court shall retain jurisdiction of this matter for the purpose of determining whether further discovery may be had with respect to the present status of the matrix scores. The writ did not say how the scores were to be disposed of, or how the claims were of with respect to the scores were to be disposed of.
Counsel?
Yes.
I have two questions for you. One is, why did you file for the fees and costs on August 4th? Why did you pick that date? Why did you choose then to file, especially if there wasn't a final order? And why, after the affidavits were filed, didn't you provide the court with a final order so that we'd know what the final order was?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, there were other matters that we were dealing with in the case. I think we had initially asked the city to stipulate to fees, and their response really did not. And we had asked for that in May. Their response came on May 31st. There were also some questions as far as the the documents that were produced, as well as the question about when and in what form were we going to get the affidavit. Why August? First of all, I guess at that point I was viewing it as something that could be filed on an interim basis, even though the case was not fully wrapped up yet. And I think more to the point, though, the question of whether of the timing of the fee petition says nothing about whether the writ itself was a final order or judgment, because this court has stated on numerous occasions that subsequent events do not not a particular order was or was not a final order of judgment. And I would say that, you know, when we filed the petition for fees does not really add anything to the question of was the April 27th writ a final order of judgment. With respect to the affidavit, I think at that point we were awaiting the court's decision on the fee application, which came down a couple of months after the affidavit was finally furnished, and at that point we did file not only the motion for reconsideration, but the motion for entry of final judgment based on our satisfaction that the affidavit that was provided in November was sufficient to convince us that further discovery would be futile.
Thank you.
Yeah. Was the August 7th filing in any way an effort to put pressure on the city to speed things up?
You know, I think I knew that the city's position on the fees and our position were very, very far apart. I certainly wanted the fee issue out there because we were entitled to that. We would have, at the end of the day, once there was a final judgment, we believed that we would have been entitled to the fees. Our position as to what the fees were was that we had expended something on the order of $15,000, and that we believed that was reasonable. And as a matter of fact, the court ultimately agreed with us on that point. Did we want the case brought to conclusion in a way that addressed the outstanding issues? Absolutely, yes.
Mr. Sweetland, why shouldn't we focus on this case like the Court of Appeals did in its last determinations and look to the fact that in January of 2007, Judge Warren gives you a decision saying your fees are reasonable, but you're not going to get them.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's May of 2007 before you appeal, well beyond the 30 days. Why shouldn't we look at those two and say you're too late?
Because, Your Honor, the finality of that January 19th decision on fees depended entirely on whether or not the writ itself was a final judgment. The statute provides, and this court has reemphasized on numerous occasions, in Womble, in the Harder versus Fitzinger case, in the Tyler versus the Riverbank case, that a final order or judgment, an appealable final order or judgment, is one that disposes of the litigation in its entirety. And when the fees were denied, the writ still had nothing had been entered that disposed of the matrix scores that either granted the writ with respect to the matrix scores or denied the writ to the matrix scores. Either absolutely or conditionally, therefore, we believe that what the position that since, under cases like ACLU versus Thompson, and I believe Herter versus Pritzinger case was the same, that if you have a final judgment on the merits, you have to appeal that right away. Later, you may get a final decision on the fees, and you have to file appeal that one right away, even though separately. And what the Court of Appeals, I think, did was they said, well, since you would have to have filed the appeal from the merits decision immediately, even though there was still a fee issue out there, if you flip it, there should be a similar rule saying that if the fees are decided first, you'd have to appeal that, even though the merits are still outstanding. And I would submit that that is like saying that since A plus B equals B plus A, therefore A minus B equals B minus A, which is not correct. And in the first case, where you have to appeal from the merits first, you have a complete disposition of the case, disposing of all issues in the litigation. And the court has made clear that the mere fact that there remains a fee issue out there doesn't change the fact that the entire matter has been disposed of on the merits. But in this case, if you have a fee determination prior to a final determination on the merits, you have not disposed of all issues on the merits.
Did you ever appeal from the final disposition as you view the final disposition?
What we appealed from, we asked the court to what we did was we filed a motion for reconsideration on the fee issue.
And then you appealed within less than 30 days of that motion for reconsideration being determined.
Yes.
Did you appeal at that point on everything, or what did you appeal on?
Yes, everything.
Not only the fee issue, but also the merits issue as well.
Well, we didn't have anything to appeal on the merits issue. We had prevailed.
Right. So you were satisfied with what you got.
There. We were satisfied with what we had gotten, but we appealed from the fee decisions on the basis that they had not, there had not yet been a final order or judgment triggering the 30 days within which to file our fee petition.
When did you get the final judgment, in your view? Well, when did you get a final judgment in this case that was appealable?
To be honest, Your Honor, I'm not sure we ever did get a final
That's
judgment.
That's the point of my question.
We've gotten a writ that says that I would say is final with respect to the applications, but left outstanding the final disposition of the matrix scores. We had two decisions on the fees. We did, when we filed the motion for reconsideration, we did attempt to file a motion for entry of final judgment on the matrix scores, and I would I think as best as I can could tell you, either we have not had a final ruling on that, or the circuit court's last order essentially denying the motion to, had the effect of denying that motion for entry of final judgment. But that's basically, I would say, where we are. We have not really had final judgment on the merits of the matrix score.
Well, did Kenosha bring in an affidavit saying that the third-party contractor had destroyed the records? before they knew about the lawsuit? I mean, isn't that what the circuit court ordered?
The circuit court ordered them to produce an affidavit. And if the affidavit was not sufficient, we would have been in a position to go back to the circuit court and say, we need more discovery. We need to send a forensic expert to go and look at the hard drive and so forth.
So where is that now? Where is that now?
What we did, we acknowledged in the motion for entry of final judgment that we filed at the same time that we filed our motion for reconsideration. We told the circuit court that we were satisfied, and the motion for entry of final judgment is at appendix number 13 to our brief.
You were satisfied that they had destroyed it?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And did they enter a final judgment?
No.
That's your problem.
That's the problem. Yes. Yes. And so we have a denied fee award based on what we believe is an incorrect characterization of the original writ as a final judgment and no further final judgment. So at that point, we concluded that really we had to bring it to the to the appellate level to try to get a ruling.
So do you view this as having won, but then lost on the fees and on the costs? Is that the position you're in?
We have, well, we certainly won on the applications.
Right.
We would agree that there was that the writ should ultimately have been denied as moot on the matrix scores because of their unavailability. And certainly, we've lost on fees. But the writ, as the circuit court indicated in its motion or in its disposition of the motion for reconsideration, that it considered those scores to have been destroyed. It was satisfied that they had been. If the circuit court had said, I'm satisfied they don't exist, so I'm denying the writ on that basis, as to the score, that would have made it the final judgment. That would have finally disposed of all the issues in litigation. But that's not what the
circuit court. Let's look at the words, because the words are important, right?
Yes.
Preemptory writ of mandamus, and that's at Appendix 5-1 in the blue brief.
Yeah.
Now, we've struggled with this issue of finality in several cases recently in the context of probate with regard to estate of Sanders and in other context insurance cases with regard to Wambold and Tyler. Wambold and Tyler set forth the same test. So let's look at the document and apply the test. And the test is, if Wambold, if you recall, was a decision on a summary judgment motion, and I think the summary judgment motion was granted. It was language in the decision that said the summary judgment motion was granted. If Wambold, it said, not good enough because the statute requires a final document must include an explicit statement, either dismissing or judging the entire matter in litigation as to one or more parties, and it must state on its face, and that's for future purposes of appeal. But look, that's language I just read from Tyler. Wamble has the same language. The decision was not final in Wamble because it, quote, did not contain an explicit statement, either dismissing the entire matter in litigation or judging the entire matter in litigation as to one of the four more parties. Show me the language in the peremptory writ of mandamus that we should be focusing on as to whether there is an explicit statement either dismissing or judging the entire matter in litigation as to one or more parties. Now, I know your argument isn't this a final document, but how about number one, paragraph one, the respondent's motion for reconsideration. Am I on the right page here? I think so. It's 5-2. Is hereby denied. Is that language sufficient to meet the test of an explicit statement either dismissing or judging the entire matter in litigation as to one or more parties? And we've got a test.
Paragraph one is simply, I think, procedural, saying their motion for reconsideration was denied.
Anything close here to meeting that test that you can point to? And I'll ask the same question of your opposing counsel. Because we've got a test, let's apply it to the documents.
Well, I would say that paragraph two, which says the petition for the writ is granted with respect to the applications, although again, the court has said that simply saying that a grant of summary judgment by itself, or grant of a motion for summary judgment of itself, is not in and of itself sufficient. It does direct the city to comply with the request with respect to the applications in paragraphs again 2-6, but I would submit that paragraph 7 has nothing. There's no language in paragraph 7 or 8 or anywhere else in this document, in this peremptory writ. And I see that my time has expired. There is no language anywhere in this writ that explicitly in any way disposes of the matrix stores. The only sections of the writ that talk about the matrix stores are paragraphs 7 and 8, which talk about there will have to be further proceedings before a final determination can be made with respect to whether or not the city must disclose that. The most that it says about that is that the city and the custodian have conceded that they are public records. That is not the same as saying the city is hereby ordered to produce them.
So am I correct in saying that maybe particular issues within this lawsuit were settled out by the judge, but that the lawsuit was still pending?
That is our position, yes, Your Honor.
And that's under 8. The court shall retain jurisdiction of this matter for purpose of determining whether further discovery shall be had.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's that still in position. The circuit court, according to you?
It should still be in the circuit court. And I believe that the case ought to be remanded with instructions to the circuit court to enter final judgment and deal with fees appropriately in light of whether or not we get our fees requested.
Would you ask for more fees now than you did before? Still been in this case.
I would supplement the fee application, yes.
So you didn't even ask for your final fees?
Not yet.
Sort of interim fees.
That's correct.
Is that clear on the face of the documents?
No, that is not clear. I would not say that is clear either.
Okay. But you're prepared to ask for more fees?
Yes.
Okay. Including this appeal or this review?
I would certainly argue for it, yes. If we prevail, I would certainly argue for it. If we don't, then...
You don't.
Then it's been a wonderful ride.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Knight, representing the city of Kenosha.
May it please the court, my name is Assistant City Attorney Matthew Knight. I appear on behalf of the respondents, the City of Kenosha, as well as the City of Kenosha Personnel Director Steve Stanzik. This matter comes before the court on the petitioner's application for review of the appellate court decision of May 28, 2008, which dismissed the petitioner's appeal on the basis that the notice of appeal filed on May the 23rd, 2007, was untimely, thereby depriving the appellate court jurisdiction over that matter. While ultimately the case is about whether or not a request for costs was timely made in view of Wisconsin Statute Section 806.064, in order to make that determination, I believe a review of the factual timeline is appropriate, and I believe some of that has occurred already. I have prepared an exhibit, a timeline exhibit, and provided a copy to counsel, and I provided a copies for your honors to the marshal. With your permission, I would request that the marshal provide you with those exhibits for your review and consideration during my time.
Do you has opposing counsel seen these?
He has. I've given him a copy.
Do you have any objection, counsel? I'm afraid you'll have to get to the microphone, please. Sorry.
My only objection is on 11906, I'm not sure I would have characterized what happened there as conclusion of discovery, but the general timeline, as he has proffered it, I have no objection to.
Thank you. The court will receive this with that proviso. Counsel, while we are getting this exhibit passed out to us, I have a question that I've been wondering about. What if, instead of providing the affidavits saying that the missing matrix scores had been destroyed, one of the vendors found them, and so the affidavit they found said, oh yeah, we didn't destroy them all, we found it on our hard drive. So that was the affidavit. Then what? Is that same order still final in your view or not?
I do believe it still is a final order, Your Honor. In response to that finding, the city surely would have, along with the affidavit, gotten a copy of whatever matrix scores were available and provided them directly to the petitioner.
Well, what if you guys didn't want to pony them up? I mean, just because the affidavit says that they're available, there are reasons why you can withhold public records. So what if there were a public record and that was a matrix score and that's what the affidavit said, then what about that April order of the court? Don't you have to have another order saying give up that score?
I don't believe so. I understand the question, Your Honor, but if you look at the transcripts from the hearing, it's clear that the city took the position that the matrix scores were discoverable. And not only that, Your Honor, the city had already forwarded the matrix scores that they had in their position with respect to other requests that had been made. Prior to the filing of the petition for writ of mandamus, there were other matrix scores requested. They were sent forth. So for me to presume that we wouldn't have wanted to send them forward, simply is based upon what we had done in the past.
Well, my concern is I shouldn't think a final order would be dependent on what you wanted to do or didn't want to do. And I think, you know, when I first read this, I thought, well, if it wasn't final when the court entered it, certainly when the scores were provided, I mean, when the affidavits were provided and you knew there were no more scores, then it ripened into a final order at that point in time. But then as I thought about it more, I thought, what if the affidavit had said, yeah, we do have some scores. And that was it. And they hadn't been provided right away. And then opposing counsel, you know, would need a court directive in order to get them. Now, even if you gave them up voluntarily, I still have a bit of trouble with the order being final if, in fact, the affidavit turned up some scores that you folks didn't know about.
I understand.
So that's what I'm stuck with, if you can help me a little bit.
I understand. What I would say, Your Honor, is simply that the document, the writ, the peremptory writ, this was an action for a specific sort of judgment. It wasn't an action for damages related to somebody breaking a leg. It wasn't an action related to enforce a contractual obligation to sell a piece of land or something like that. They came forward and asked for a specific document. They asked for a peremptory writ of mandamus and included the matrix scores as well as the applications. At the conclusion of the hearing with respect to those matters, a document was created, a peremptory writ of mandamus, created by the petitioner to include the items that we were going to provide to them pursuant to the court's order. In the event that they thought that peremptory writ was insufficient because it didn't specifically address the matrix scores, they very well could have said, Your Honor, we'd rather have you wait on issuing this writ of mandamus and issue it after we have completed our discovery so that we can include specific information with respect to the destruction or the finding of additional information that was being requested. That wasn't done.
Well, they probably believed what you said, which proved to be truthful, right? I mean, hadn't you submitted a hearsay affidavit saying we talked to the guys that had these and they're all destroyed? And, you know, I think there's no reason not to rely on counsel's representations. I mean, I think lawyers do it all the time. So, okay, well, that was my problem. If the affidavit had been different, I couldn't see how the order was final. Counsel, I want to ask you the same question I asked opposing counsel. In Tyler and Wamble, the court formalistically followed 808.03, which deals with appeals to the Court of Appeals and appeals as of right finality. And both opinions said that the decision was not final because it did not contain an explicit statement either dismissing the entire matter in litigation or adjudging the entire matter in litigation as to one or more parties. So that's the test. We need an explicit statement. We don't, you know, previously we had cases that dealt with, well, did the judge contemplate something else? And we said, let's just stick with the language of the statute. That's the test. And it's got to be an explicit statement, not, does it smell like, does it sound like, three syllables? No, an explicit statement. So show me, let's go to the documents, and I am eager to find out, let's start with the peremptory writ of mandamus. Where in the peremptory writ of mandamus, and I don't mean to ask this as challenging you at all, I mean, if it's there, show it to me, I just haven't seen it. Where is the explicit statement dismissing the entire matter in litigation or judging the entire matter in litigation as to one or more parties?
Your Honor, I believe the language appears on the top of page 2. It's in bold type, in capitalized type, and it says, now therefore, it is hereby ordered, adjudged, and decreed that the following things are going to happen pursuant to the petition for the writ of mandamus filed with this court.
Okay, you're there part of the way. The test is an explicit statement, either dismissing the entire matter in litigation
Okay.
Or adjudging the entire matter in litigation as to one or more parties. So you got the word adjudged, and so let's go from there.
Okay.
Where's the rest of the explicit statement?
The next paragraph that I think is informative is paragraph 6, where it says that the city and the custodian shall forthwith provide copies. Again, a direction that something needs to occur now. We've been directed to provide them copies at this point in time. So we have it adjudged. Now we have direction and action that needs to be taken.
Is that the entire matter in litigation?
Well, Your Honor, I understand it's the petitioner's position that the matrix scores were also in litigation, but I believe if you look at the remainder of the writ, paragraph 7 and 8 deal with the conclusion that the matrix scores aren't available, that we're going to provide additional documentation which shows the petitioner that they're not available. And finally, I think that at paragraph 8, what is of note is that the court's talking about retaining jurisdiction of this matter for the purpose of further discovery. If this were not a final document, what would be the purpose of that language? Why would the court need to do anything in terms of retaining jurisdiction?
If there's an explicit statement, either dismissing the entire matter in litigation or judging the entire matter in litigation, you would not have any retention of jurisdiction. The whole concept that that the court is retaining jurisdiction means the whole thing isn't dismissed or adjudged. There's still something to do.
Well,
you might think you're going to win once you do the affidavit in 7, but the judge hasn't said so yet.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, but this needs to be supplemented, I believe, with the instruction and the direction that the circuit court judge provided at the time that he issued his decision on April the 27th, as well as May the 20th, I believe, of 2006. In both instances, the judge was talking about retaining that part of the jurisdiction with respect to discovery, but he was also alluding to the city's ability to appeal this decision.
That's what the judge intended, but we got rid of, you know, what does the judge contemplate? That was part of the problem prior to Rambold and Tyler. So you either have it or you don't. And I'm hoping you, for your benefit, I hope that you have it. For your opposing counsel's benefit, I hope you don't. You show me where it is, an explicit statement either dismissing the entire matter of litigation or judging the entire matter of litigation as to one or more parties. The discussion about, well, you got to put this in context, you know, that's explicit is what I would emphasize. So where?
I can't put words into the document that aren't there. I've highlighted the sections of the document that I believe make it a final document. I've also indicated that it's my belief that the contemporaneous statements of the judge when he was issuing the order do matter, and I think that there is appellate court discussion with respect to that fact. Specifically, there's a case, State v. Wright, which specifically addresses that specific issue, that the court's contemporaneous comments can be considered in determining whether an order was intended by the trial court to be the last document.
Yeah, that's the old, I mean, that's prior to Rambold and Tyler, I would assume, isn't it?
Well,
what's the date?
If we look at Rambold, if we look at the test provided in Rambold, it does include a component with respect to, it's a two-pronged test that Harder put forth first and subsequently was followed in Rambold and Tyler and in a long line of cases.
Well, I am put my finger on it. But that's one of the reasons for the Lambeau and Tyler case, and that is that, Lambeau was a decision, a memorandum decision.
Yes, ma'am.
The judge had all the rationale in it. The judge granted the motion for summary judgment. The judge said in that there are no viable claims that the plaintiff has against the defendant insurance company. Grant the defendant insurance company's motion for summary judgment. That's all, and the reasoning for that was all in the Lambeau memorandum decision. And yet, that wasn't good enough. It was because, why? Because there was no explicit language consistent with 80803.
And as I've said, Justice, I can't write any more language into the document that's there. I believe that the document on its face is a final judgment. I believe that the Tyner case cited in our brief indicates that on their face, peremptory writs are going to be judgments for the purpose of 80303 review. We believed it to be a final document. If they didn't believe it to be a final document when it was entered, they should have challenged it at that point. They shouldn't have waited until almost 8.5, 9 months later to first bring it before the court for review.
Counsel, a moment ago you mentioned the statements that were made by the trial court at the time of the April 27, 2006 order. And I'm looking at page 14 of the transcript of that. And you state that with respect to the matrix scores, quote, I have not prepared an affidavit. I think Your Honor has requested that we look into getting the affidavit signed by the company that performed that testing. I will do that, end quote. At the bottom of the page, the court responds to you and says that my only concern in mentioning that, as you properly indicated, it's a recommendation, it's certainly not an order. You respond, I understand, and the court responds, it was simply to save everyone the expense of further discovery. What would have happened if you hadn't been so diligent, and if you hadn't, in fact, got the affidavit? Wouldn't you expect opposing counsel to have requested another hearing?
I would have expected a motion for further discovery, Your Honor, yes. I think the language used there, again, is important, that he was not making an order with respect to discovery, that he was requesting that it be done. I think that that was done because the assumption was that I was going to get him the information that was being requested. We had already conceded that fact, that if they were there, we would get it and give it to them. I think that that's why the court was careful not to instruct as an order, but rather as a request.
But that came after, or contemporaneously anyway, it appears, with your representation that it would be done. Now, yes. You know, one of the things that we have to be mindful of is not only how our decision will affect this case, this particular case, but how it will affect other cases. And let us just presume sometime down the road we have a similar situation, and we don't have quite as diligent of an attorney who's making the representation. My question to you is, wouldn't there have been another hearing? And you already answered that, yes, you would expect there'd be another hearing. So I guess that brings me back to the question of how is that a final order?
Well, Your Honor, I would hope that, given the course that the law has moved from Lambeau to Tyler to Sanders, and with the more restrictive requirements in terms of what needs to be contained within those new orders, hopefully that is what's going to be or prevent this sort of thing happening again. Your Honors noted that, you know, the federal court has a specific rule with respect to entering a document known as a final judgment. This state doesn't have that. We've moved in this other direction with respect to this case law, and hopefully that's going to resolve the issue that we have here in this case. Again, I think that the other alternative would have been to wait on the writs, to wait on the documents until they were convinced that there were no matrix score records to receive. They wanted the documents when they wanted them. They wanted the issue ordered on the 27th when we were back before the court, and that's why it happened. Now, I think in addition to that, I understand that the decisions talk about further circuit court action not being dispositive as to whether or not something was or was not final, but I think that all the parties here, and that's one of the reasons I put the timeline together, I think that the parties here all knew that peremptory writ was in fact the final order with respect to this litigation. Counsel on the second item on my list there, it's contained within the record, record number 27, exhibits D and E, are copies of the proposed fee stipulation, as well as letters that was forwarded to me as early as May the 8th, 2006, requesting that I stipulate to fees, as well as containing an order for me to forward the order to the judge to sign at that time. Everyone, the issue of whether or not this was a final writ or not a final writ never became, it wasn't an issue until they filed the petition and then I objected to the timeliness of the petition. That's when the writ became, is it final, is it not final? Everyone was under the same assumption that it was final until I made my objection. And I would note that in terms of when they filed their petition, the 8th, because we were in dialogue about whether we would be stipulating, wouldn't be stipulating, that didn't resolve his obligation to file the petition in a timely fashion if, in fact, the writ were the final document, and he would have had to file within 30 days of that document.
Counselor, I'm looking at your timeline, and you've got something on November 9th, 06 as conclusion of discovery.
Yes, ma'am.
If the matters pending between the party on petitioner's request for documents and your compliance with that were done, why would you need a conclusion of discovery many months later?
That conclusion had to do with respect to those affidavits that were requested by the judge. That was the last date I forwarded the last affidavit to
I
the petitioner.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
And again, that's the date of my letter. Council may have received it a day, two, a week later, but sometime in early November, that part of the request from the judge was concluded.
Thank you. And your timeline does not show entry of final judgment.
Your Honor, that's because I believe that the entry of the final judgment was the peremptory writ of mandamus, which was filed April the 27, 2006. If we move down, the notice of appeal was filed after the memorandum decisions of February the 5th, 2007 and February the 26th, 2007. But from our perspective, we had always been of the belief that the peremptory writ was the final judgment. We didn't submit another document because we were of the belief that the case had concluded at that point.
Is there any policy reason why petitioners shouldn't get attorney fees?
The only policy is a statute which requires them to file within 30 days of finality of the action. Otherwise, I concede with respect to them having substantially won with respect to the merits of the case. They were entitled, pursuant to the public records request and public records statutes, they were entitled to attorney's fees as a result of receiving the peremptory writ of mandamus.
You must have had some negotiation, according to your timeline, about attorney fees. Not too long after 4/27/06.
That's correct. There was very short discussion, maybe one or two phone calls, one or two letters. It wasn't very extensive. Again, though, I do believe it relative the fact that they're asking for an order on May 8th with respect to fees. A lot of what they have argued is that there still has been no final order. Well, if there hasn't, then we shouldn't be fighting over whether or not I'm going to sign a stipulation in order for fees or whether a petition for an order of fees should be entered. The other thing I know, in looking at the proposed judgment forwarded, as Your Honor notes, it really is no, I don't think it even meets the standard that the peremptory writ meets. I think that the peremptory writ has the language adjudged with respect to the claim and the petition sought. The petition is a very specific sort of action. The writ is the result of that action. This, as Your Honors noted, talks about denying and entering. It doesn't dismiss anything. It doesn't adjudge anything. So I do believe that that there's an issue there as well, Your Honors. With respect to the appellate court decision, I think the appellate court has made the correct determination with respect to this in light of the timeline and in light of when the appeal was filed, concluding that the judge's memorandum decision of the 19th provided an avenue to appeal and to look at the issue of fees when he denied those motions. The petitioners asked the court for reconsideration on that issue. They could have at that point, in my view, filed an appeal on the issue, but chose to ask for reconsideration. The judge reconsidered and came to the same conclusion that they were late in their filing, and therefore their motion was denied with respect to attorney's fees. I think that the case law is clear that in terms of post-litigation motions that are not directly on the merits of the case, a motion like fees, the proper course in terms of resolving those sorts of claims is to deny them if they have no merit, or to grant them and enter an order with respect to granting them if there is merit. I think that that's what happened in Tyler with respect to the post-trial motions. I think that's what happened in the ACLU case as well with respect to the post-trial motion to have a new judgment, the old judgment vacated and a new judgment entered. That motion was simply denied, and that was the decision that was appealable. Based upon the congruence of the information contained within the first motion on the fees and the motion for reconsideration, I think the Court of Appeals properly determined that those contain the same issues, and because they contain the same issues, the proper date for determining when an appeal should be filed was in fact the January 19th date of 2007, as opposed to the February 26th date of 2007. And on that basis, they had filed their appeal in excess of the time period required under 808.04.1, and therefore they dismissed the appeal as untimely. With respect to additional fees from this point forward, Your Honors, the argument now has been put forth that no judgment, no appealable judgment has been entered, and therefore this needs to go back to the beginning. The argument is we filed the appeal too early. That causes me some pause when I hear that they're going to be looking for additional fees when their argument essentially is we filed too early, and therefore we created all this additional litigation, and now we're going to go back and ask for our fees with respect to it.
Well, Counselor, didn't they have two choices? They could either just accept the fact that they weren't going to get any fees because the Court of Appeals found the appeal untimely, or they could continue to believe that there wasn't a final judgment entered, but no one was hearing what they were saying and bring it to us and hope we'd take it and we'd agree.
That's true. I do believe that Judge Warren in the Circuit Court did make a determination with respect to finality twice. So they did have that argument heard, and our position is they didn't pursue their means of appellate review in a timely basis, and that's why it was denied at the appellate court level.
Sure, and if you are correct, the court decides you're correct, obviously they won't get any more fees.
That's correct.
Yeah. Counsel, since there's a pause, let me fill the void. The other document is the decision on April 27th, 2007. That is the focus of our inquiry. Can you point out any language that explicitly has an explicit statement either dismissing the entire matter in litigation or judging the entire matter in litigation as to one or more parties?
Your Honor, are you referring to the Circuit Court Memorandum Decision, April 26, 2007, that's what you're referring to?
Correct. Isn't that what
yes.
is the focus of our attention? Yes. That's at Appendix
3-1-ish.
I have one that's on the blue brief. It's 3-1.
I think that the language in this document, and I think that this is distinguishable from a final adjudication which disposes of the merits of the case. This is an adjudication with respect to a post-litigation motion. And with respect to that, the court goes on for several pages about why he's not going to issue issue fees. And finally, the last sentence of the document indicates that the petitioner's application for costs and fees remains denied. I believe that with respect to post-litigation motions, the appropriate document and the dispositive words, if a motion is not going to be granted, is to simply deny the motion rather than to dismiss or to adjudge the motion.
Chief, if I may?
Yeah.
That's, I think you're looking at two different documents.
I'm looking at April 26, 2007.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it says on page, in my, what I'm looking at is 4.3. Says that he made an oral decision, and then he says that there's nothing substantive left to be done. And then he says that the only reason that the court is holding it open was to confirm in writing rather than in hearsay that that the matrix scores of Centelli and Weber were no longer in existence. Go ahead.
I mean, that's exactly it. My question remains the same, and I don't know if the chief has assisted you, but I ask, the only thing that you've appointed to is after reconsideration, the petitioner's application for costs and fees remains denied. That's an awfully lot like denying the motion. Rather granting the motion for summary judgment in Lambos.
It is, but for the fact that the summary judgment motion in Lambos was on the merits of the case. This is a decision with respect to the fees after the merits, in my view, have been resolved.
Fair enough. Thank you for that. Let me just then clarify. From your comment, it appears that you are not asserting that this April 27, 2007 decision of Judge Warren would meet the test of finality you are not asserting that it contains an explicit statement either dismissing the entire matter in litigation or adjudging the entire matter in litigation as to one or more parties. Is that correct?
It does not explicitly dismiss or judge matters as to one or more parties. It denies the matter before the court.
Thank you, thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Sweetland, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I just have a few points to make. The counsel said, well, this was an action for a writ of mandamus, and that we got our writ of mandamus, but the writ of mandamus left part of the litigation open. Counsel refers to the Tyner case, which is not only a pre-Rambolt case, but it's also a pre-808.03 case. So that when Tyner was decided back in the late 70s, and the court there held that peremptory writs of mandamus are immediately appealable, they were not subject to the explicit commands of 808.03, the limiting commands of 808.03, which say that a final judgment is one that decides that disposes of the entire matter in litigation. Whether it would have been better to wait until the question of the matrix scores had been decided finally before issuing the writ is really of no consequence to whether the writ that was filed was final. The writ that was filed did not finally dispose of or adjudge the claims with respect to the matrix scores. If the court agreed with the city that the hearsay affidavit was sufficient, it could then have ruled the matrix scores do not exist. I'm denying the writ with respect to those because they do not exist. It didn't do that. And so as for the question whether the motion for reconsideration was proper after the initial denial of the fees, again, the whole question of whether a motion for reconsideration is an appropriate substitute, and if so, under what circumstances, an appropriate substitute for an immediate appeal. Is a rule that depends on, again, there having been a final judgment. And since there was no final judgment on the merits, at least that is our contention, there was also the January 19th ruling on the fees was also not a final judgment from which appeal had to be immediately taken as opposed to a motion for reconsideration. Those are all my comments. If any of the justices have any further questions, I'm certainly here to answer them. But if not, then I would, thank the court for its attention.
This is sort of off point, but there's the affidavit of Timothy Tompkins.
Yes.
Is there any subsequent affidavit about those matrix scores?
Yes, there was. It was an affidavit from... Thank you. I guess in paragraph four of my of the petitioner's motion for entry of final judgment, it simply recites that the respondents all have provided an affidavit from a representative of the aforesaid contractor. Counsel is providing me with a copy of an affidavit that was signed on October 31st, 2006 by Robert Bezat of the PAR Group, in which he states that I have reviewed the records of the PAR Group related to the recruitment for the position of City of Kenosha Fire Chief, specifically related to Matthew Weber.
I think the question I have is that does the timing of that second affidavit bear on anything?
I would say no, Your Honor, because by that time we already had our fee petition in. Yes, it is an affidavit from Jim Sparr, S-P-A-R-R, of Almont Associates, Inc., which states that Almont Associates, pursuant to contractor's agreements, conducted the assessment centers for the positions of City of Kenosha Fire Chief, paren 2004, close paren, and City of Kenosha Deputy Fire Chief, paren 2003, close paren, that the matrix scores from the assessment centers previously identified were in the ordinary course of business destroyed on or before December 7th, 2005, which was when the initial open records command was made. That at this time, no record of the identified matrix scores exist, that there are no residual files in any of our computers or documents where the matrix scores would reside, that I have no information as to how any of the destroyed materials could be received, and that affidavit is dated October 2nd, but that is the one that was finally provided to us on November 9th of 2006.
Mr. Sponsor, do you have any other questions? Hearing none, thank you, Council. I want to thank both Mr. Sweetland and Mr. Knight for their argument in the umpteenth case we've had as to when and what judgment is final for purposes of appeal. That concludes our argument in 078P1198 Kenosha Professional Firefighters versus the City of Kenosha. We are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45, and the court will convene in the conference room at about 3:15.